whilst educating myself in the nuts and bolts of hawk training, I was unconsciously soaking up the assumptions of an imperial elite. I lived in a world where English peregrines always outflew foreign hawks, whose landscapes were grouse moors and manor houses, where women didn't exist. These men were kindred spirits. I felt I was one of them, one of the elect. I became the most appalling falconry bore. On wet afternoons after school, my mum would be writing up news stories for the local paper, court reports, local fates, planning committees, fingers hammering away on her typewriter in the dining room. There'd be a pack of Benson and Hedges on the table, a cup of tea, a shorthand notebook, and a daughter standing next to her, reeling off imperfectly remembered sentences from 19th-century falconry books. It seemed crucial to explain to my mother that while dog leather was the best leather for hawk leashes, it was almost impossible to get these days. That the problem with merlins was that they're prone to carry their quarry. And also, did she know that saker falcons, hailing from desert areas, are unreliable performers in English climatic conditions? Lining up another yellow piece of copy paper, fiddling with the carbon so they didn't slip, she'd nod and agree, drag on her cigarette and tell me how interesting it all was, in tones that avoided dismissiveness with extraordinary facility. Soon, I was an expert on falconry, the way the carpet salesman who used to come into the bookshop where I once worked was an expert on the Greco-Persian Wars. Shy, crumpled, middle-aged and carrying with him the air of some unspoken defeat, he rubbed his face anxiously when he ordered books at the till. He wouldn't have lasted long, I think, on a battlefield. But he knew everything about the wars, knew each battle intimately, knew exactly where the detachments of Phocian troops were stationed on high mountain paths. I knew falconry like this. When I got my first hawk years later, I was astounded by the reality of the thing. I was the carpet salesman at the Battle of Thermopylae. It is summer 1979, and I am an 8-year-old girl in a bookshop. I'm standing under a skylight with a paperback in my hand, and I am extremely puzzled. What is an 18th-century story of seduction? I had no idea. I read the words on the back cover again. The Goshawk is the story of a concerted duel between Mr. White and a great beautiful hawk during the training of the latter, the record of an intense clash of wills in which the pride and endurance of the wild raptor are worn down and broken by the almost insane willpower of the schoolmaster falconer. It is comic, it is tragic, it is all-absorbing. It is strangely like some of the 18th-century stories of seduction. Nope. Still no idea. But I needed the book all the same, because on the cover was a goshawk. She looked up from under her brows in truculent fury, her plumage scalloped and scaled in a riot of saffron and bronze. Her talons gripped the painted gloves so tightly my fingers prickled in numb sympathy. She was beautiful, taut with antipathy, everything a child feels when angry and silenced. As soon as we were home, I raced upstairs to my room, jumped onto the bed, lay on my tummy and opened the book. And I remember lying there, propped on my elbows with my feet in the air, reading the opening lines of the Goshawk for the very first time. When I first saw him, he was a round thing like a clothes basket covered in sacking. But he was tumultuous and frightening. Repulsive in the same way as snakes are frightening to people who do not know them. It was unusual. It didn't sound like my other falconry books at all. The 8-year-old girl that was me read on with a frown. It wasn't anything like them. This was a book about a falconry by a man who seemed to know nothing about it. He talked about the bird as if it were a monster, and he wasn't training it properly. I was bewildered. Grown-ups were experts. They wrote books to tell you about things you didn't know, books on how to do things. Why would a grown-up write about not being able to do something? What's more, the book was full of things that were completely beside the point. It talked disappointingly of things like fox hunting and war and history. I didn't understand its references to the Holy Roman Empire and Strindberg and Mussolini, and I didn't know what a Pickelhaube was, and I didn't know what any of this was doing in a book that was supposed to be about a hawk. Later I found a review of the book in an old British Falconers Club journal. It was superbly terse. For those with an interest in the dull, introspective business of manning and training a hawk, The Goshawk will be a well-written catalogue of most of the things one should not do, it said. The men in tweed had spoken. I was on the right side, was allowed to dislike this grown-up and consider him a fool. It's painful to recall my relief on reading this, founded as it was on a desperate misunderstanding about the size of the world. I took comfort in the blithe superiority that is the refuge of the small. But for all that, my 8-year-old self revered the hawk in the book. Goss. Goss was real to me. Goss had steely pinions and a mad marigold eye, and hopped and flew and mantled his great wings over a fist of raw liver. He cheeped like a songbird and was terrified of cars. I liked Goss. Goss was comprehensible, even if the writer was utterly beyond understanding. A few years ago, I met a retired U-2 pilot. He was tall, flinty and handsome, and had just the right kind of deadly stillness you'd expect from a man who'd spent years flying at the edge of space in a dusty black American spy plane. The geopolitical aspects of his role were truly disconcerting, but as a day job, it was absurdly cool. At 80,000 feet, the world curves deep below you, and the sky above is wet, black ink. You're wearing a spacesuit, confined to a cockpit the size of a bathtub, piloting a machine that first flew the year James Dean died. You cannot touch the world. Just record it. You have no weapons. Your only defense is height. But as I talked with this man, what impressed me the most weren't his deadpan tales of high adventure, the incidents with Russian MiGs and so on, but his battle against boredom, the 9-hour solo missions, the 12-hour solo missions. Wasn't that horrendous? I asked. It could get a little lonely up there, he replied. But there was something about how he said it that made it sound a state still longed for, and then he said something else. I used to read, he said unexpectedly. And with that, his face changed, and his voice too. His deadpan Jaeger drawl slipped, was replaced with a shy, childlike enthusiasm. The Once and Future King, by T.H. White, he said. Have you heard of him? He's an English writer. It's a great book. I used to take that up and read it on the way out and the way back. Wow, I said. Yes. Because this story struck me as extraordinary, and it still does. Once upon a time, there was a man in a spacesuit in a secret reconnaissance plane reading The Once and Future King, that great historical epic, that comic, tragic, romantic retelling of the Arthurian legend that tussles with questions of war and aggression and might and right and the matter of what a nation is or might be. White is not a fashionable writer. When I read English at university, his name wasn't mentioned at all. But once upon a time, White was very famous indeed. In 1938, he published a children's book about the boyhood of King Arthur called The Sword in the Stone, and it made his name and his fortune. Disney snapped up the rights and turned it into an animated cartoon. White went on to write The Once and Future King, which covered the rest of the Arthurian story, and that in turn inspired the stage musical and film Camelot. White's reworking of Arthurian legend was hugely influential. When you hear Kennedy's White House described as Camelot, that is white. Jackie Kennedy quoted lines from the musical after her husband's assassination. When you think of the wizard Merlin wearing a tall peaked hat embroidered with stars, that is white too. And when I think of the U2 pilot up there, reading a book about King Arthur, a book that had been wrenched strangely into a fairy tale about American political life, I can't help but think of a line written by the poet Marianne Moore. The cure for loneliness is solitude. And the solitude of the pilot in the spy plane, seeing everything, touching nothing, reading the once-in-a-future king 50,000 feet above the clouds, that makes my heart break just a little, because of how lonely that is, and because of some things that have happened to me, and because T.H. White was one of the loneliest men alive. The Goshawk is the book of a young man. It was written before White's better-known works, and before he was famous. It would be about the efforts of a second-rate philosopher, he explained sadly, who lived alone in a wood, being tired of most humans in any case, to train a person who was not human, but a bird. When I read it again, years after that first childhood encounter, I saw more in it than bad falconry. I understood why people considered it a masterpiece. For White made falconry a metaphysical battle. Like Moby Dick or The Old Man and the Sea, The Goshawk was a literary encounter between animal and man that reached back to Puritan traditions of spiritual contest, salvation as a stake to be won in a contest against God. That older, wiser me decided that White's admissions of ignorance were brave rather than stupid. But I was still angry with him. First, because his hawk had suffered terribly as he tried to train it. And second, because his portrayal of falconry as a pitched battle between man and bird had hugely influenced our notions of what goshawks are and falconry is. Frankly, I hated what he had made of them. I didn't think falconry was a war, and I knew hawks weren't monsters. That small girl lying crossly on her bed was still cross. That is what I thought as I sat there staring at the open book on my desk 4 months after my father died. I read on, and as I did, there was a tiny jolt that was a realization of why my eyes had spurned that book for weeks. I knew that part of why I was cross was that I felt for the first time that my urge to train a hawk was for reasons that weren't entirely my own. Partly, they were his. Chapter 4. Mr. White. It is the 16th of March, 1936. On the east side of the great Palladian palace that is Stowe's school, jackdaws fuss in the sweet chestnut trees, water drips from the roof of the block of rooms that used to be the stables, and inside them, Mr. White, head of English, blankets bunched up against his shins, is balancing a notebook on his knees and writing fast in a small, clear hand. He wonders if this is the most important book he's ever written, not because it will make his fortune, but because it will save him. He thinks he will leave. School life is unreal. All this is unreal. He's had enough. He can't bear his colleagues. He can't bear the boys anymore either. En masse, he thinks, they're horrible, like haddocks. He has to get out. He'll live on his writing. His last book did well. He'll write more. He'll take a cottage in Scotland and spend his days fishing for salmon. Perhaps he'll take the barmaid with him as his wife, the dark-eyed beauty he's been courting for months, though he's only in love with her emotionally so far, and he hasn't got anywhere really, and those long hours sitting at the bar reduce him too often to hopeless drunkenness. He drinks too much. He has drunk too much and he has been unhappy for a long time. But things are certain to change. The notebook he writes in is grey. He stuck a photograph of one of his grass snakes on the cover and written etc. above it in ink. The snake is suitable because this is his dream diary, though there are other things in it too, scraps of writing, lesson plans, line drawings of sphinxes and clawed dragons rampant, and the occasional stab at self-analysis. 1. Necessity of excelling in order to be loved. 2. Failure to excel. 3. Why did I fail to excel? Wrong attitude to what I was doing? But mostly the notebook records his dreams. There are dreams of women with penises, of boxes of maidenheads like fingernail parings, of hooded cobras that rear up but turn out to be harmless. There are dreams that he has forgotten his gun but can't borrow his friend's because his friend is giving it to his wife. That he is a spy on the Hitlerists, hiding in a hole with only his cigarette poking out. That he must hide his shotgun in the boot of his mother's car to stop it being struck by lightning. And a dream in which his psychoanalyst is congratulating him on how good his dreams are. Bennett is the name, initials E.A., wrote White to Leonard Potts, his old tutor at Cambridge, who was something of a father figure. He is a very great man. Must be, because cured cases like mine are, I believe, most rare, if not unique. And then there's an assurance that is surely his wishful invention of some future self. I had a friend who was a sadistic homosexual, now happily married, with children. For the last year, White's craze for analysis had been in full spate. He was certain that Bennett would cure him of all of it. His homosexuality, his unhappiness, his sense of feeling unreal, his sadism, all of it, all his confusions and fears. It was all going well. He was almost sure he was in love with the barmaid. "I'm so happy, I hop about like a wagtail in the streets," he told Potts, with a pride that holds within it, cupped like a small bird in the hand, his abject terror of failure. The boys treated him with a kind of holy awe. Pacing the long corridors in grey flannels, a turtleneck sweater and gown, Mr. White looked a little like Byron. He was tall, with full lips and very pale blue eyes, a trim red moustache and dark, unruly hair. He did all the right things, flew aeroplanes, shot, fished for salmon, hunted, and even better, all the wrong things, kept grass snakes in his room, rode his horse up the school steps on match days, and best of all, published racy novels under the pseudonym James Aston. When the headmaster found out, he was furious. Mr. White had to write him a letter promising never to write such filth again, said the boys, who passed copies of the novels around in agonies of delighted subterfuge. He was a startling, light-hearted, sarcastic figure, but a forbidding teacher. He never beat boys ever, but they were terrified of his disdain. He demanded emotional sincerity. If it wasn't forthcoming, he'd cut his pupils down to size, puncturing their new-grown armour of pretension with a relish that bordered on cruelty. Even so, there was something about Mr. White that made him an ally of sorts. Boys confided in him in a crisis, and they worshipped him for his insubordination and glamour. They knew he didn't fit, not quite, with the rest of the masters at Stowe. "Did you hear about the time he crashed his Bentley into a farmhouse and nearly died?" they whispered. And they spoke gleefully of the legendary Monday morning when Mr. White arrived late and hungover, ordered the class to write an essay on the dangers of the demon drink, put his feet on the desk, and fell fast asleep. But for all his demonstrations of bravado and skill, Mr. White, Mr. Terence Hanbury White, known to all as Tim after the chemist chain Timothy White's, was terribly afraid. He was 29 years old, had been a schoolmaster at Stowe for 5 years and a writer for 7, but he had been afraid as long as he could remember. "Because I am afraid of things, of being hurt and death, I have to attempt them," he'd explained in a book of sporting essays, England Have My Bones, published the previous year. He had to be brave. From the schoolroom, he'd race at top speed to the aerodrome, his heart tight in his mouth, afraid of stalling, afraid of the instructor's contempt, afraid of getting himself into a spin from which he'd never recover, of burying himself in a wreck of crumpled wings and struts and earth. He rode with the Grafton over the muddy fields of Buckinghamshire in perpetual terror that he would fail to be brave, fail to ride well, fail to pass himself off as a gentleman, would incur the wrath of the master of foxhounds. And back in India, right at the beginning, where he remembered lizards and fireworks and candle-lit darknesses and grown-ups in evening dress, he remembered also the terror of beatings and arguments, and his mother's hatred of his father, and his father's hatred of her, and his drinking, and the endless, awful, violent war between them, in which he was the pawn. His mother lavished attention on her dogs, and her husband had them shot. She lavished attention on the boy, and the boy was convinced he'd be next. "I'm told," he wrote, "that my father and mother were to be found wrestling with a pistol, one on either side of my cot, each claiming that he or she was going to shoot the other and himself or herself, but, in any case, beginning with me." And then, "It was not a safe kind of childhood." He brings the end of the fountain pen to his lips and considers what he has written. "I pounce upon a bird with cruel talons and desperate beak. It may have been hurting me a little, but it would have hurt much more if I had let go. I held it tight and powerless to harm me, calling for somebody else to help by holding its feet. It was an English bird." When White died of heart failure in January 1964, far from home in a cabin on the SS Exeter in Greece, his friends were concerned for his reputation. There were things in his journals they did not want to come to light, matters relating to his sexuality that, if spoken of at all, had to be handled with rare delicacy. They needed to find a suitable biographer. They chose Sylvia Townsend Warner, because she had corresponded with White and he had liked her books. And for another reason, she was gay. "You will be sympathetic to his character," Michael Howard informed her. "If it is a sufficiently bad character, I should certainly be sympathetic to it," she replied. She travelled to Alderney, and there, walking about White's house, she found her subject. He was there, in his possessions. She wrote to her friend, William Maxwell. His sewing basket with an unfinished hawk hood, his litter of fishing flies, his books, his awful ornaments presented by his hoi polloi friends, his vulgar toys bought at Cherbourg fairs, his neat rows of books on flagellation, everything was there, defenceless as a corpse. And so was he, suspicious, morose, and determined to despair. I have never felt such an imminent haunt. An imminent haunt. Her phrase gives me pause, because that was what White was doing as I trained my hawk. He was there even as I dreamed of the vanishing Goss, haunting me. Not in the tapping-on-the-window, white-sheet, ghost-in-the-corridor way, but it was a haunting all the same. Ever since I'd read The Goshawk, I'd wondered what kind of man White was, and why he had tied himself to a hawk he seemed to hate. And when I trained my own hawk, a little space opened, like a window through leaves onto this other life, in which was a man who was hurt, and a hawk who was being hurt, and I saw them both more clearly. Like White, I wanted to cut Liz from the world, and I shared, too, his desire to escape to the wild, a desire that can rip away all human softness and leave you stranded in a world of savage, courteous despair. The book you are reading is my story. It is not a biography of Terence Hanbury White, but White is part of my story all the same. I have to write about him because he was there. When I trained my hawk, I was having a quiet conversation of sorts with the deeds and works of a long-dead man who was suspicious, morose, determined to despair. A man whose life disturbed me, but a man too who loved nature, who found it surprising, bewitching, and endlessly novel. "A magpie flies like a frying pan," he could write, with the joy of discovering something new in the world. And it is that joy, that childish delight in the lives of creatures other than man, that I love most in White. He was a complicated man and an unhappy one. But he knew also that the world was full of simple miracles. "There is a sense of creation about it," he wrote in wonderment, after helping a farmer deliver a mare of a foal. "There were more horses in the field when I left it than there were when I went in." In England Have My Bones, White wrote one of the saddest sentences I have ever read. "Falling in love is a desolating experience, but not when it is with a countryside." He could not imagine a human love returned. He had to displace his desires onto the landscape, that great blank green field that cannot love you back, but cannot hurt you either. When, on their final meeting, he confessed to the writer David Garnett that he was a sadist, Garnett blamed White's early emotional maltreatment and years of flogging at school. "He was an extremely tender-hearted and sensitive man," Garnett wrote, "who had found himself always in the dilemma of either being sincere and cruel or false and unnatural. Whichever line he followed, he revolted the object of his love and disgusted himself." When White took up his position at Stowe in 1932, he was already expert at hiding who he was. For years he'd lived by the maxim Henry Green put so beautifully in his public school memoir, Pack My Bag. "The safest way to avoid trouble, if one may not be going to fit, is to take as great a part as possible in what is going on." To gain approval, to avoid trouble, he had to mirror what was around him. It was how he had tried to win love from his mother as a child. It was a life of perpetual disguise. After leaving Cambridge with a first in English, White had decided to become a toff. That was the phrase he used. "Snobbery is one of the best parlour games," he explained to Potts with light-hearted casualness, but it was a game with the highest of stakes. He had to pass himself off as a gentleman. He took up the correct pursuits, shooting, fishing, flying, and fox hunting. The latter was a perfect challenge. There were 1,000 rules and protocols. It required bravery, money, social skills, horsemanship, and exquisite feats of disguise. "Can one wear topper, black coat, and jacks without tops?" he anxiously inquired of his Cambridge friend, Ronald McNair Scott. He was not sure about breeches. "Mine are the right kind of buff, I think, a sort of khaki. But perhaps the weave or cording or whatever you call it is too coarse, or not coarse enough?" Too coarse, not coarse enough. He kept meticulous hunting diaries to record his progress, number of miles hacked and coverts drawn, people encountered, hedges and ditches successfully taken, thoughts on his horse's conduct, and painfully circumlocutory assessments of his own. "I believe I did not misbehave myself, and was certainly at no time rebuked," he wrote. Defensive, negatively couched, these are the words of a man desperate to belong. In England Have My Bones, he describes Buckinghamshire in a similar way, through what it is not. His county lacks outstanding qualities, beauty, and historical significance, and so it avoids the attention of the world. It is safe. When White goes on to explain how Buckinghamshire concealed its individuality in order to preserve it, but is secretly exuberant in its private way, you realize that he is writing about his own character. More disguises. The mirror works both ways. The lines between the man and landscape blur. When White writes of his love for the countryside, at heart he is writing about a hope that he might be able to love himself. But the countryside wasn't just something that was safe for White to love. It was a love that was safe to write about. It took me a long time to realize how many of our classic books on animals were by gay writers who wrote of their relationships with animals in lieu of human loves of which they could not speak. Gavin Maxwell's Ring of Bright Water, for example, the tale of a lonely man on the Scottish coast with an Iraqi otter on his sofa, or the books of the BBC radio naturalist Maxwell Knight, former MI5 spymaster and closet queen. Doubly disallowed to speak openly of his allegiances, Knight wrote a book about hand-rearing a cuckoo called Goo. His obsession with this small, greedy, feathery, parasitic bird is terribly moving. It was a species made of all the hidden elements of Knight's life, subterfuge, deceit, passing oneself off as something one is not. White is part of this poignant literary tradition. He remained alone all his life. He had a few dispiriting romances with women, nearly married one, almost proposed to another. All were very young. He was frightened of grown women. He confessed that he found their shape unpleasant and could scarcely bring himself to draw it. Much later in life, he fell for the teenage son of a friend. It was his last love, hopeless and unreciprocated. But there were always animals. They populated White's life and his books. Dogs, owls, hawks, snakes, badgers, hedgehogs, even ants. And apart from his much-loved setter, Brownie, whom he adored, he insisted his animals were never pets, for pets were almost always fatal, to oneself or to them. They are ruined by their owners the same way that mothers ruin their children, choke them like ivy. Pets meant dependency, and he had a terror of it. One of the chapters in England Have My Bones is prefaced with a passage from Stella Benson that sheds light on why White dreamed of a hawk. Independence, a state of being self-contained, is the only generosity, I thought, the only charity we can claim of a living creature. We must have nothing to do with another's bones. That is our only right, to have nothing to do with them. The bone must be the axis of a globe of intrusion-proof glass. One could not say, watching a hawk, I ought perhaps to do this for him. Therefore, not only is he safe from me, but I am safe from him. While still a schoolmaster, he bought two Siamese cats, a breed renowned for its independence, and tried to train them to place no reliance or affection upon anybody but themselves. It was what he had been trying to do himself for years. In vain, he concluded with disgust. Far from wandering free and independent, they sleep all day in the sitting room, in the intervals of mewing at me for more food. The cats were a failure. The grass snakes he kept in his rooms were not. He kept them because it was impossible to impose upon them or steal their affections. He loved them because they were misunderstood, maligned, and inevitably themselves. They were versions of the self he aspired to be, just like the characters he called to life in his books. Merlin, the perfect teacher, Iwart, the orphan who was born to be king, and Sir Lancelot, the ill-made knight, whose character White made his own. Lancelot was a sadist, who refrained from hurting people through his sense of honour, his word. His word was his promise to be gentle, and it was one of the things that made him the best knight in the world. All through his life, White wrote of Lancelot, even when he was a great man with the world at his feet, he was to feel this gap, something at the bottom of his heart of which he was aware and ashamed, but which he did not understand. White always took great pains to be gentle, precisely because he wanted to be cruel. It was why he never beat his pupils at Stowe. And though abjuring cruelty was White's word, animals played a curious role in keeping it. Riding out with the old Surrey and Burstow hunt, White recorded the first time he saw a kill with distanced fascination. The fox was dug out of a drain where it had taken refuge and thrown to the hounds. They tore it to pieces while a circle of human onlookers screeched them on. The humans, White thought, were disgusting, their cries tense, self-conscious, and hysterically animal. But the hounds were not. The savagery of the hounds, he wrote, was deep-rooted and terrible, but rang true, so that it was not horrible like that of the human. In this bloody scene, only one man escaped White's revulsion. The huntsman, a red-faced, grave and gentlemanly figure who stood by the hounds and blew the mort on his hunting horn, the formal act of parting to commemorate the death of the fox. By some strange alchemy, his closeness to the pack, his expert command of them, the huntsman was not horrible. For White it was a moral magic trick, a way out of his conundrum, by skillfully training a hunting animal, by closely associating with it, by identifying with it, you might be allowed to experience all your vital sincere desires, even your most bloodthirsty ones, in total innocence. You could be true to yourself. When White dreamed of the hawk, his false self was cracking under strain. He felt himself boiling with a strange unrest, was increasingly out to shock and appall. Colleagues remember him turning up to parties, drunkenly announcing, "This party has no racial future. Parties should be like bird sanctuaries. People should come to them to mate." He decided he hated people. He preferred animals. He was still drinking too much. He'd already turned on his former loves of fox hunting and flying. They were adulterated with death and snobbery and the desire to excel, and they were founded on poor motives, the fear of falling and the fear of failing. Gentility was a game he had played, but the reasons for playing it had been wrong. He was putting it aside. "I was like that unfortunate man in Thurber who wanted a packing case in which he could conceal himself," he wrote, "and the solution seemed to lie in splendid isolation." He went fishing alone in Belmullet on the west coast of Ireland during the spring vacation. It made him more than ever certain of his course. From Belmullet he resigned his post at Stowe. "It needed courage," he told Potts, "because my analyst has only got me about one quarter of the way. I don't know what my future is going to be, if I have a future." And then, "The barmaid is a complete write-off." And there was a new terror. It was war. Everyone felt it drawing closer, an almost tangible thing, acrid as sweat after nerves. "We all stand in the shadow of a great fear," the Oxford historian Dennis Brogan had written 2 months earlier. "And if the angel of death is not yet abroad in the land, we can hear the beating of his wings and see them too filling our old familiar sky." White saw it too, and wrote that the war was the fault of the masters of men everywhere, who subconsciously thrust others into suffering in order to advance their own powers. His fear of war meshed darkly with all his other fears. He'd long had nightmares of bombs and poison gas, of tunnels and flight and escape routes under the sea. The previous year he'd published Gone to Ground, a kind of mid-century Decameron, in which fox hunters hiding in an underground bunker told each other stories as gas bombs and incendiaries fell from the sky to obliterate the whole, nervous, broken thing that was civilization. Civilization was over. It was pointless. Modernity was bunk and danger and politics and posturing, and it was going to lead to the end of everything. He needed to run. Perhaps he could escape to the past. It would be safe there. He started reading a book on falconry by Captain Gilbert Blane. It was there that White came across a story of a lost goshawk. From being on the day on which she was lost as domesticated as a household parrot, Blane recorded, she had reverted in a week to a feral state and became thereafter a myth and legend in the neighbourhood. For White, the sentence was an epiphany. The hawk was a myth, a legend. There was a sentence which suddenly struck fire from the mind, he wrote. The sentence was, she reverted to a feral state. A longing came to my mind then that I should be able to do this also. The word feral had a kind of magical potency which allied itself with two other words, ferocious and free. Fairy, fey, aerial, and other discreditable alliances ranged themselves behind the great cord of ferox. To revert to a feral state. I took a farm labourer's cottage at 5 shillings a week and wrote to Germany for a goshawk. Feral. He wanted to be free. He wanted to be ferocious. He wanted to be fey, a fairy, ferox. All those elements of himself he'd pushed away, his sexuality, his desire for cruelty, for mastery. All these were suddenly there in the figure of the hawk. White had found himself in the hawk that Blane had lost. He clutched it tightly. It might hurt him, but he wouldn't let go. He would train it. Yes, he would teach the hawk, and he would teach himself, and he would write a book about it, and teach his readers this doomed and ancient art. It was as if he were holding aloft the flag of some long-defeated country to which he'd staked his allegiance. He'd train his hawk in the ruins of his former life. And then when the war came, as it surely would, and everything around him crumbled into ruin and anarchy, White would fly his goshawk, eat the pheasants it caught, a survivor, a yeoman living off the land, far from the bitter sexual confusion of the metropolis or the small wars of the schoolroom. Chapter 5. Holding tight. When you are broken, you run. But you don't always run away. Sometimes, helplessly, you run towards. My reasons weren't White's, but I was running just the same. It was a morning in early August, and I was 400 miles from home. What I was doing felt like a drugs deal. It certainly looked like one. For minutes on end, I'd paced up and down a Scottish quayside, with a can of caffeinated soda in one hand, a cigarette in the other, and an envelope stuffed with £800 in £20 notes in my back pocket. Over there, in the car, sat Christina, spectacularly impassive in a pair of aviator shades. She'd come along to keep me company, and I hoped she wasn't bored. She was probably bored. Perhaps she was asleep. I walked back to the car. It was my father's. I was driving it now, but the boot was full of things I couldn't bring myself to remove. 35mm film canisters, a crushed packet of aspirin, a newspaper with a half-finished crossword in my father's hand, a pair of winter gloves. I leaned against the bonnet, rubbed my eyes, and looked out at the harbour, willing the ferry into view. A clear pool of turquoise was spreading out there over the Irish Sea. Small crosses that were gulls traversed it. It seemed strange that it was day at all. Both of us were wiped out from yesterday's long drive and faintly freaked out by the hotel we'd stayed at the night before. 21st Century Hotel, it said, on a laminated paper sign by the door. When we opened it, the first thing we saw was a plastic bulldog sitting on a desk, grimacing at us with the malevolent, merry belligerence of a thing from a nightmare. In the hotel room we found a broken computer, a sink that wasn't plumbed in, and a fully functioning cooker we'd been instructed not to use under any circumstances. Health and safety, the hotelier had explained, rolling his eyes. There were, unexpectedly, two televisions, acres of brown suedette stapled onto the walls, and a bathroom with a 6-foot sunken bath into which Christina subsided, marvelling at the tea-tinted peat water. I collapsed into a chair, the journey running in my mind like a road movie directed by a drug-addled auteur. Giant iron-brew trucks full of orange, bubblegum-flavoured fizzy Scottish soda. A raven standing in a puddle by the side of the road, wet-trousered and chisel-beaked. Motorway service station A. Motorway service station B. A sandwich. A large cup of undrinkable coffee. Endless miles. More skies. A near accident caused by inattention on a hillside somewhere. Motorway service stations C and D. I massaged my aching right calf, blinked away the after images, and got to making Jess's. I should have made them before, but I couldn't. Only now did the hawk seem real enough to make them necessary. Jess's are the soft leather straps that fit through the leather anklets on a trained hawk's legs. Singular, Jess. It's a French word from the 14th century, back when falconry was the favourite game of the ruling elite. A little scrap of social history in the name for a strip of leather. As a child, I'd cleaved to falconry's disconcertingly complex vocabulary. In my old books, every part of a hawk was named. Wings were sails, claws pouncers, tail a train. Male hawks are a third smaller than the female, so they are called tiercels, from the Latin tertius, for third. Young birds are eyuses, older birds, passagers, adult trapped birds, haggards. Half-trained hawks fly in a long line called a creance. Hawks don't wipe their beaks, they feak. When they defecate, they mute. When they shake themselves, they rouse. On and on it goes in a dizzying panoply of terms of precision. The terms were precise for a reason. Knowing your falconry terminology attested to your place in society. Just as in the 1930s, T.H. White worried about whether a hunting crop should be properly called a hunting whip or a riding crop or a riding whip or just a crop or a whip, so in the 16th century, the Jesuit spy Robert Southwell was terrified he'd be found out because he kept forgetting his falconry terms. But the words weren't about social fear when I was small. They were magic words, arcane and lost. I wanted to master this world that no one knew, to be an expert in its perfect, secret language. You can buy it all on the internet now. Jesses, hoods, bells, gloves, everything. But when I began falconry, most of us made our own equipment. We'd buy swivels from deep-sea fishing shops, leashes from ships' chandlers, beg offcuts from leather tanneries and shoe factories to make our own jesses and hoods. We adapted, we adopted, we usually didn't improve. Certainly I didn't. I spent countless hours waxing cotton thread, punching holes in my hands instead of leather in error, frowning, wiping blood away, trying again and again to cut and make and sew things that looked like the photographs in books, waiting for the glorious day when I might have a hawk of my own. I have a suspicion that all those hours making jesses and leashes weren't just preparation games. In a scrapbook of my childhood drawings is a small pencil sketch of a kestrel sitting on a glove. The glove's just an outline and not a good one. I was 6 when I drew it. The hawk has a dark eye, a long tail, and a tiny fluffy spray of feathers under its hooked beak. It is a happy kestrel, though a ghostly one. Like the glove, it is strangely transparent. But one part of it has been carefully worked. Its legs and taloned toes, which are larger than they ought to be, float above the glove, because I had no idea how to draw toes that gripped. All the scales and talons on all the toes are delineated with enormous care, and so are the jesses around the falcon's legs. A wide black line that is the leash extends from them to a big black dot on the glove, a dot I've gone over again and again with the pencil, until the paper is shined and depressed. It is an anchor point. "Here," says the picture, "is a kestrel on my hand. It is not going away. It cannot leave." It's a sad picture. It reminds me of a paper by the psychoanalyst D.W. Winnicott, the one about a child obsessed with string. A boy who tied together chairs and tables, tied cushions to the fireplace, even, worryingly, tied string around his sister's neck. Winnicott saw this behavior as a way of dealing with fears of abandonment by the boy's mother, who'd suffered bouts of depression. For the boy, the string was a kind of wordless communication, a symbolic means of joining. It was a denial of separation, holding tight. Perhaps those jesses might have been unspoken attempts to hold on to something that had already flown away. I spent the first few weeks of my life in an incubator, full of tubes under electric light, skin patched and raw, eyes clenched shut. I was the lucky one. I was tiny, but survived. I had a twin brother. He didn't. He died soon after he was born. I know almost nothing about what happened, only this. It was a tragedy that wasn't ever to be spoken of. It was a time when that's what hospitals told grieving parents to do. Move on. Forget about it. Look, you have a child. Get on with your lives. When I found out about my twin many years later, the news was surprising, but not so surprising. I'd always felt a part of me was missing, an old, simple absence. Could my obsession with birds, with falconry in particular, have been born of that first loss? Was that ghostly kestrel that grasped at apprehension of my twin, its carefully drawn jesses a way of holding tight to something I didn't know I'd lost but knew had gone? I suppose it is possible. But now my father had died. Hold tight. I hadn't ever imagined that making jesses could be a symbolic act, but as I sat there, cutting hide into long strips, soaking them in warm water, stretching them, greasing them with leather dressing, turning them this way and that in this strange room of broken objects, I knew they were more than just pieces of leather. These were the cords that would hold me to the hawk, just as they would hold the hawk to me. I picked up the craft knife and tapered the end of one jess to a point with a long, smooth cut. There. I was conjuring presences doing this. Suddenly the hawk was very real. And so, in a burst of remembrance so fierce he could have been there in the room, was my father. Grey hair, glasses, blue cotton shirt, a tie slightly askew, a cup of coffee in one hand and a look of amusement on his face. He used to make me cross by calling falconry equipment by the wrong names. He'd call hoods hats, creances bits of string. He did it on purpose. I'd get cross and correct him, thinking he was teasing me. Now I saw that Dad had known exactly what these things were called. But in the world of a photojournalist, the more expert you were, the less likely you were to call anything by its proper name. For him, photographs were snaps. Cameras simply kit. It wasn't ever teasing. He was paying me a compliment. Bloody 14th century French vocabulary. Shit. Shit, shit, shit. It wasn't his way at all. My throat hurt, my eyes hurt too, and my heart. I cut the end of the other jess, shaking fingers. Then I placed the two jesses side by side on the glass tabletop. they matched. Tomorrow, I thought, I am meeting a man I don't know off the Belfast ferry, and I'm going to hand him this envelope full of paper in exchange for a box containing a goshawk. It seemed the unlikeliest thing imaginable. The goshawk I was about to collect had been bred in an aviary near Belfast. Breeding goshawks isn't for the faint-hearted. I've had friends who've tried it and shaken their heads after only one season, scratching their newly greyed hair in a sort of post-traumatic stupor. Never again, they say, ever. Most stressful thing I've ever done. Try it, you discover there's a very fine line between goshawk sexual excitement and terrible mortal violence. You have to watch your hawks constantly, monitor their behaviour, ready yourself for intervention. It's no good just putting a couple of goshawks in an aviary and leaving them to it. More often than not, the female will kill her mate. So instead, you house them in separate but adjoining solid-walled aviaries with a barred hatch between the two, through which the pair can see each other. As winter turns to spring, they conduct their courtship like Pyramus and Thisbe through the gap in the wall, calling, displaying, dropping their powder-blue wings and fluffing their white undertail coverts that look for all the world like a pair of capacious marabou bloomers. And only when the female seems ready, a piece of fine judgment that does not admit error, do you let the male into the breeding chamber. If all goes well, they mate, lay eggs, and a new generation of home-bred goshawks, downy white chicks with bleary eyes and tiny talons, enters the world. I'd never met the breeder of my new hawk, but I knew already he was a man of steel nerves and superhuman patience. White's hawk was taken from the wild. No one bred goshawks in captivity in the 1930s. There was no need to try. There were 100,000 wild gosses out there in European forests and no import restrictions to speak of. Like nearly all falconer's goshawks back then, White's had come from a nest in Germany. A bundle of precipitous sticks and some white droppings was how he imagined his hawk's birthplace. He'd never seen a goshawk nest. But you can see one, and there's no need to strike out into the forest to do so. There's live feed of goshawk nests now on the internet. One click and you're given an up-close and personal view of the family life of this most secretive of hawks. There, in a 4-inch box, in low-resolution glitter, is a square of English woodland. The hissing you hear from your computer speakers is a digitized amalgam of leaves, wind, and chaffinch song. You see the nest itself, a bulky concatenation of sticks, pushed hard up against conifer bark and lined with sprays of green leaves. On the webcam, the male goshawk appears on the nest. It's so sudden and he's so brightly, shiny white and silver grey that it's like watching a jumping salmon. There's something about the combination of his rapidity and the lag of the compressed image that plays tricks with your perception. You carry an impression of the bird as you watch it, and the living bird's movements palimpsest over the impression the bird has made until he fairly glows with substance. Goshawk substance. And he bows his head and calls. Choo-choo-choo-choo-choo-choo. Black mouth, soft smoke, in the cold April morning. And then the female arrives. She's huge. She lands on the edge of the nest and it shakes. Her gnarly feet make the males look tiny. She's like an ocean liner, a Cunard goshawk. And on each leg, as she turns, you can see the leather anklets she wears. This bird was bred in captivity somewhere, in an aviary just like the one in Northern Ireland that bred mine. She was flown by a nameless falconer, was lost, and now here she is, settling on 4 pale eggs, being watched on computer screens as the very type of the wild. Time passed on the Scottish Key, and brightness moved in from the sea. Then a man was walking towards us, holding 2 enormous cardboard boxes like a couple of oversized suitcases. strangely alien suitcases that didn't seem to obey the laws of physics, because as he walked, they moved unpredictably, in concert neither with his steps nor with gravity.